order. We are going to start off with House Bill 2892. 2892 has become known as the Open Source Software Bill, and I know that when we're done with that, we will probably end up clearing the room because I think most of you are here for 2892. Just a couple of rules of engagement is what I would like to give you. We've dedicated an hour for this hearing. That doesn't necessarily mean that you need to speak for an hour. What it means is that we've got that amount of time. I'm going to call you up in panels, and what I would like to do, people that I have from on my list here, I'm going to call you up in panels, and we're going to give 30 minutes for the proponents and 30 minutes for the opponents. Just remember that if as a proponent you speak for longer than the more time that you take, the more time you take away from one of your colleagues who might also have an important point to make. The other thing is that if you agree with something that's already been said, you can just tell us that you agree with something that's already been said. Please don't feel like you have to repeat everything that has already been said. And finally, is that if you have written testimony, it would be fine for you to turn that into, you give it to Gina and she'll make sure that the committee gets it. And rather than read your testimony, what you might want to do is paraphrase your testimony, and then that way we're able to get more people to speak. Let's see what other. I think that is about it as far as rules of engagement. We're going to have a little bit of fun this morning as well. So I thank you all for being here and welcome to General Government. After the first panel or so, I'm going to give courtesy to Representative Dalto, or he's going to send me a note when he's ready to come up, right? So, with that, Representative Przanski, would you kind of do this? Since Representative Barnhart is still among the sick and ill, would you do the honor of sort of introducing this for us, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Representative Barnhart wanted to be here, committee members. Unfortunately, he's still on the road to recovery from his appendix being removed, and he was not able, under doctor's orders, to be here. His staff has provided to us a copy of his statement, and instead of reading that into the record, I'd ask that everyone please refer to it. This is a bill that Representative Barnhart brought forward at the request of the requester, Mr. Barber, and he is going to be part of the first panel. This is going to discuss the reasons why open source software and open source open standards is appropriate and should be considered by the state in their deliberation prior to purchasing either software or having standards set for the software protocol that they use. With that said, I'd ask that the first panel of proponents to come forward and identify yourself and let's move forward.
Okay. Representative Nelson, how about if I give you courtesy about the same time I do Representative Dalto? Is that okay with you? Yes, it is sometime today. And if you would, make sure that you state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Ken Barber, the bill's author. I'm a native Oregonian. I've been an IT worker for about 20 years. I hold two certifications, one from Microsoft Corporation, the much coveted Microsoft Certified Systems Engineer certification. I also hold a security certification from the SANS Institute. I've worked for some of the largest IT organizations in Oregon. I spent a year in desktop support at Intel Corporation. I've worked at Tektronix, Nike, and I've worked for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I also spent 3 years as the network administrator at Northwest Christian College in Eugene. It was my experience at ODOT that prompted me to approach Representative Barnhart with this bill. There are a lot of software products out there on the marketplace. You can use Windows, you can use a Macintosh. There are other products that the general public might not be aware of, but there's a wide variety out there. and they're not all equal in terms of security, reliability, stability, and cost of ownership. In a free market, the best products would normally rise to the top, but the software marketplace is not a free market, has not been for about the last 10 years. Through that time, there's been a slow bias that's been developing among IT decision makers, not only in the state of Oregon, but also in business and academia. And IT administrators in a lot of places are now choosing suboptimal products that are well known in the IT community for actually being the least stable, the least secure, and the most expensive of all the choices available. The purpose of this bill is to remove that bias and put state IT decision making back onto a level playing field as it should be, so that IT administrators are free to make their own decisions. The bill will encourage IT decision makers to, quote, think outside the box, unquote, instead of thinking only in terms of solutions that certain very highly skilled marketing departments want them to do. Others are going to talk about the immense cost savings that are available to the state of Oregon by going to free or open source software. I'm going to talk, and that's probably, that alone would be a good enough reason for the committee to pass this bill out to the floor for a vote. But I'm going to talk about a couple of other things that might even be more important than money. And those things are things that are crucial to any democracy, to any free people. One of those has to do with public data. A government in a democracy holds data that's owned by the public in trust for the public. It's absolutely essential in a democracy that a government always be able to access that data that belongs to the public. Unfortunately, there are products coming down the road very soon now, possibly later this year, more likely next year, that employ a strategy called vendor lock-in, where data that is stored on computer systems will be accessible only by the software that stored it. It will be, because of software patents, it will be against the law to reverse engineer those file formats. The state of Oregon is coming very close to painting itself into a corner where public, you will have to pay a vendor somewhere for the right to access the state's own data. That is simply unacceptable in a free society and in a democracy. The other issue that I was going to bring up, other than money, is the one about privacy and security. The citizens' rights to privacy are fundamental. Any democratic government really needs to be paying attention to privacy rights. And yet, in the latest version of Microsoft Windows, there is software that every time the user listens to a music CD, Windows XP reports to Microsoft who you are and what you're listening to. This happens without the knowledge or consent of the person operating the computer. Now, at home or in a business, that's a decision that the individual computer user can make. In a government, where you're dealing with DMV records, welfare records, health issues, that raises some serious questions. If today Microsoft is gathering information on what music you're listening to, what information will they be gathering tomorrow? How long will they retain the data? Who are they going to share the data with? Those are all questions that legislators need to be addressing They need to be addressing it now. The Oregon Department of Transportation knows about this problem. The last time I was there, they were trying to figure out how to block it. They had not figured it out. And yet, ODOT today is involved in converting thousands of computers all over the state to Windows XP, even though they know there's a privacy hole in it. There is also a service pack to Windows XP that, you know, when you install an upgrade or something, there's this page of legalese that you have to click in the bottom that says, I agree. Nobody ever reads it, right? The latest service pack to Windows XP, if you read that, there's legal language in there where you grant Microsoft the right to come into your hard drive by remote control and remove anything they deem objectionable. Now, there's no code in Windows at present that's actually doing any of that. But as soon as you install this, you've granted them the legal right to do that. That's not acceptable in a free society. For those reasons, and the financial reasons, which hopefully you'll be hearing a lot about today, I urge the committee to pass this bill out after considering the amendments that Representative Barnhart and I want to introduce, but we don't have them ready today.
Chair and members of the committee, my name is Shane Norton. I'm a private citizen from Washington County. I'd like to speak my support also of this proposed bill. I'd like to address the support in three areas, most of them dealing with the concept of open standards. Open source supports what is called open standards. And open standards is very similar to the way we share all human knowledge today. I'm speaking to you, of course, in English because we've all agreed as a free society what these words mean. And you can understand me completely because anyone who speaks English, anyone who learns English can communicate. And communicate with anyone else who speaks English, no matter where you learned it, if you learned it from a book, if you grew up in another country, if you grew up in America. So we have these open standards also in software, where anyone who is free to write software that implements these open standards can communicate with any other software that implements these open standards. And open source software, free software, both do this to a great extent. Part of that is pragmatic reasons. It's nicer to play nicely with the rest of the world, to communicate with the rest of the world, than to wall yourself in a corner. And part of it is just because that's the way freedom goes. With open source software, I have a choice of which vendor I'd like to use. If I write documents to an open format, anyone else who receives that document can use their choice of software to read that format. And that's vitally important, I feel, in a government sitting where we're dealing with public data, especially data that can last for years and years, as you've heard before, government records, financial dealings, DMV records, health issues. The choice of software that the government makes and the choice of document standards the government chooses based on that choice of software influences the types of software, the types of participation that citizens can have in government. By choosing open standards and open source software, you're in effect saying to citizens, you're welcome to participate on your own terms with the software that you choose, provided you stick with these open standards that any vendor is free to implement. Whether you want to use proprietary software as a personal citizen, that's fine. Whether you want to use open source software because of cost reasons, because of philosophical reasons, that's fine as well. We are guaranteeing that the business of government, the data we store in government, is made available to you in an open format that is completely accessible no matter how you want to use. And that, in my mind, can only increase citizen participation, which is vital in a representative democracy, as you certainly know by me sitting here. In effect, citizens can say they can go out to, say, an internet cafe or a downtown location in downtown Portland like the Free Geek Center, where they can sit at a computer for free, access software they can legally use for free, even take a computer home for free and access vital government information, improve their lives by participating in government. By choosing proprietary software, you would deny them of that right, unless you also ensure that the proprietary software uses an open format. And that is not the preferred way for most proprietary software. Data has a nice way of outliving software. In other words, the application upgrade cycle may be 18 months, maybe a year, maybe 3 years. But the usefulness of data does not stop after 18 months. And by choosing open source software where the source code can live on, even if there may be no benefit in selling that software, the information required for someone of knowledge, someone you could hire, maybe even yourself, to understand that information that that application shares is still there. So if you'd like to see the utility of data live on beyond even the life cycle of a commercial application, I urge you to consider open source software that implements open standards and open data formats.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Crummell, distinguished representatives of the committee, my name is Cooper Stevenson. I live at 1303 North Heights Drive, Northwest, in Albany, Oregon. I come to you today to focus on the security aspect of open source software. Today, information technology systems are an integral aspect of all operations within an organization, both in government and in private enterprise. As the computer systems have grown, we have gone from single PCs to PCs that are networked, not only to other agencies, but also to the outside world and suppliers. While this communication has revolutionized the method in which data is transferred, it also presents a significant security risk. That in combination of the foundation that computers are integral to the operations of government give us an intense need to make sure that our systems are secure. The open source development practices, by their very nature, produce code that is more secure than proprietary software. And the reason for that is because open source programmers tend to be participants in their field of professions and members of a community of developers into which their applications are released. So what that means is that application developers who write open source code are already prominent members of their respective community. A network programmer is already generally a respected member of his community. Those who write web browsers are already respected members of their community. The truth is, they write this code because they love it. Further, they participate in an open forum by which their code is under stringent review by thousands of programmers around the world for security exploits and code, making sure that code is clean. If an issue is found with a piece of code, that issue is immediately brought to attention. Members of the open source community work on that code. They work out a solution, and hopefully, and usually what does happen in practice, the code is improved at the next release, and generally happens even before the first release. So by its very development nature, the source code, the code that comes out from open source, the open source community, is generally more reliable. Not only is the development platform more conducive to secure code, it's also more open to scrutiny once the code is released into the public. In fact, what we find in the open source community is that code exploits generally are received as soon as a code exploit is received, an alert is sent out, many, many people around the world work on the alert, and a patch is released, often within hours of the original alert. This is much more beneficial to both government and private enterprise because in the case of governments, they are not reliant on a single vendor to release a patch for a known software exploit. They don't have to rely on a particular vendor to run to patch the problem. And in the case in the past, what we found is sometimes this can take months. So I'd just like to sum up today with the idea that not only is open source software more conducive in its environment in which it is developed to creating secure software, patches are also released much more quickly and without reliance on a particular vendor to fix these security holes.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions for our first panel? I do have one quick question, if I might, Cooper. You mentioned security patches and that sort of thing, and I know, irrespective of whether it's been proprietary or open source software, that patches security has been a major issue. With regards to that, how does the open source community feel about going to a system where you don't need patches, utilizing mandatory access control lists and that sort of thing?
We love it.
Okay. Thank you.
One question.
Representative Avakian.
Just in case it doesn't come up in the other panel that comes up, is there any difference between the, I guess, traditional software that's being used now and the one you're proposing with regard to virus infection?
Yes. First, the Unix or Linux and Unix and the Berkeley System Division operating systems and platforms, along with their respective applications, think about security first and features second. And part of the reason for that is that there's not necessarily a profit motive for releasing features as fast as we possibly can without thinking about security. The base architecture of these platforms are such that if an exploit were to get in, for the sake of argument, get into the system, its very nature limits the damage that it can do. And the reason why it is that way is because the architecture is founded on permissions. So an exploit can only do as much as the permissions of the user who runs the exploits. And when you combine that, which when you take that in conjunction with the idea that the operating system is conducive to just simply restoring the data from tape, it's a thistle patch for exploits.
You got to boil that down to more layman's terms.
Okay, sorry,
Mr.
I think what you're saying is I access information. If there is a virus, it's contained within my unit and doesn't get out within the entire system.
That's absolutely correct, Mr. Vaughn.
How's that different from what we have now?
Computer users on proprietary formats we've known in the past have, if I may, godlike privileges on a machine. They, by using the machine, have privileges to wipe out an entire machine. In the past, there's been no concept of restricted access.
Okay. One other question I'd like to ask us and need a fairly quick response to, and that is, Mr. Barber, I think you mentioned proprietary software denies the right to access of government documents. Or maybe it was you. One of you did. Anyway, my question is, aren't the servers that would be provided, that if you were logging on to a government, for example, if you go to the National Archives website, aren't the servers that you're logging on to actually transparent to the user, so that if we're sitting at our house and you log onto the archives website, you can pull down whatever documents your hard drive can hold and that sort of thing, and it doesn't really matter what you're running versus what the servers are running at the archives?
Chairman, in an ideal world, that would be true. And it makes a lot of common sense that it would be. Unfortunately, it's not that easy. The choice of software you make may prefer that you produce documents in a specific type of document that myself as an open source user would not normally be allowed to use.
Oh, I see. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And I'm going to, at this point, allow courtesies to our two representatives and Greg Unrein. And then Eric and Paul, I'd like to go to you to come up and give your presentation. Okay. And I don't know whether Representative Nelson, Representative Dalto, and Mr. Unrein are proponents or opponents. Doesn't matter. Come on up. You're next. And I don't care which one of you starts, but go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Kremel. Two gentlemen I'm sitting with, so they've allowed me to go first, and I thank you very much for this opportunity to address this committee on the issue of House Bill 2892. Basically, the concept is, I know it from the information I have now without the amendments, is basically a good idea. Unfortunately, not practical. I am here to oppose this bill. And I would like to give you the reasons why. First of all, I believe it's restrictive in nature to the process of choosing the most cost-effective solution, and I see little value to the state or the citizens in general. Second, I believe it simply adds another layer to the acquisition process and thirdly, opens an opportunity to challenge a selection of a given software solution if indeed the solution was not an open source solution. I also believe the process is already open and competitive, with the end goal being the best return investment for the state, and that's how it should be. The state has already the flexibility to consider open software. It does not need another law. If the system is not open, agencies are in breach of state law and need to be appropriately disciplined. If that is the case, we need to take the ruptured appendix out and restore the wellness of our public body. And that's with respect to the good Representative Barnhart, who's not here today because of that surgery. While I realize how hard it is to get accurate, reliable data in formats I like, I believe that is an issue with agency management, management of access, of control, and concern for security, not the issue of software. Thank you for allowing me to express those opinions today and those of my county commissioners, also my county communications manager, as well as my county clerk of Yamhill County. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. For the record, Billy Dalto, State Representative, Oregon House District 21. I'm here this morning in support of House Bill 2892 for a few reasons. The first reason is, given Oregon's economic climate, we and all of you are in a daily fight to find dollars for essential services. And I think any steps that we can take to reduce costs, and in particular technology costs, which are substantial, I think are worthwhile. In my mind, as I understand House Bill 2892, it mandates nothing on the Department of Administrative Services, simply that they consider open source technology and include it in the information technology deliberative process to clear any institutional biases against open source or what I consider to be participatory software. Because it doesn't have any mandates, I'm not really sure what the objection is, because we're not forcing IT administrators to do anything here. Finally, I will just say that information technology is constantly evolving. Systems are always increasing their capacity for speed, power, depth of scope, what they can do. And while technology continues to change, government doesn't. And government, by its very nature, is resistant to change. And as all of you know, it's very slow and tedious to get things done in this building, and that's by design, and that's good. But when we have increases in technology, we should be able to apply them, and we should have the flexibility to apply those increases. And I think that's what this bill would do. It would make people consider, or at least allow them the opportunity to consider incorporating some of those changes. The flexibility is a great tool. We shouldn't be afraid of it. Is open source technology superior to the alternative? I don't have the answer to that question. I'm sure there are dozens of people behind me that could probably debate that with you. But certainly, if it is, shouldn't we have the flexibility to adopt that or implement that? And I think that's what this bill does, is give us that sort of intellectual flexibility. And so I would encourage you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Henry?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Greg Unrein. I'm a citizen of Beaverton. The previous panel basically covered most of my statements, but I would like to address one issue that I didn't see addressed very well, and that is I think that the most important message that this bill proposes is to let state administrators understand that the public and the state legislature would like to see them consider open source solutions in addition to the proprietary vendor solutions. And I believe that because of the nature of open source, there is less of a marketing push, less of a business push on the state and on those administrators to make decisions that use or utilize open source software. And so basically, I think that is one of the key pieces of why this bill is important, is that it sends that message that, yes, the people and the legislature would like those open source solutions considered well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr.
Are there
Chair.
Questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mabry?
Excuse me, I do need to identify myself as State Representative Donna Nelson from District 24. I apologize.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Mabry?
I feel compelled to tell everybody that I'm absolutely lost in this arena, so I don't know. But maybe a comparison that you could help clarify. If I'm putting out a contract for breakfast cereals for the state prison system as a department head doing that, And I say, okay, I have to talk with Post and Kellogg's and General Mills or General Foods or whatever they are. But now all of a sudden I have a bill that says I also have to consider Mabry's Muslick as one of those alternatives. As a department head that has to now consider that product that I don't know anything about. I don't know what the food content, what the sanitation is, what anything is. It seems to me that I have just muddied the water a lot, requiring me to do a lot more stuff, and then I'm probably going to go to Kellogg's anyway because I'm confident in it. And it seems to me that this issue maybe is in that same arena. It certainly is for me because I don't understand it. But could you address that in some way?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mabry, I think that the way to look at it, it's a little bit different analogy than the one you presented, sir. What you have with open source software is not necessarily yet another vendor that's simply being legislated into, you have to consider my product, which for that vendor would be very nice. But it's not what open source, it's not just one vendor, it's not just one product. It's a whole host of products that solve all kinds of computer problems. Those computer problems and those solutions have been developed by the people that use those solutions. That's why they make them. They want the solutions. It's a very community-oriented process. It tends to be very democratic, and what it ends up doing is supplying the best possible solution to that problem domain. I don't believe this is muddying the waters by requiring a specific vendor to be utilized or analyzed. What it does is it simply states that these solutions should be considered along with any other proprietary solutions or closed solutions that are being presented. And I don't think that it favors any one vendor in particular. It simply asks, the state is simply asking state agencies to examine those solutions that may not be, let me back up just a moment, these solutions may not be being presented to the state by a vendor. So the state is actually, would be nice for them to look at the open source solution outside the vendor process, I guess, okay, because it's not necessarily being supplied by a vendor. I don't know if I helped you at all.
A little bit, but boy, that's a lot when you're dumb as I am.
Okay, are there any other questions for this panel? Great, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paul and Eric, Paul Nelson and Eric Harrison, I'd like you to come up and...
Let one other person that's joining the team.
Pardon?
There's one other educator that's coming up with.
Oh, okay. Great.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and representatives. I'm Paul Nelson. I'm a classroom teacher. I'm one of those reviled Tier 1 PERS employees. But I've been teaching
This isn't the PERS
yeah.
hearing.
I've been teaching for 20 years. And I'm going to tell you, I'm from Riverdale High School in the Portland area. I'm the technology coordinator there. And we're small fry. Eric Harrison from the Multnomah County ESD is going to follow me. He's big fry. But I want to tell you about how this stuff works. It's practical, it saves us money, and it actually returned me to the classroom this year, which I really enjoyed. We opened a brand new high school this fall. We put in 80 open source workstations. We saved $40,000. Last year, I spent all day keeping our traditional workstations running. I would go to one virus-infected machine to another. I would go to machines that kids had destroyed the hard drives on, done all kinds of crazy things to. This year, I don't have to do that. And there have been a lot of studies that show it takes less time to maintain the open source systems that people are talking about. And that's been true in my school. Now I teach three-quarter time instead of working on computers all day. And so the savings for our district is not just the cost up front. It's the cost of getting my teaching time back. It's also the cost down the road. The representative talked about virus software. If the state of Oregon has 50,000 machines and pays $10 a year for virus software, that's a lot of money. We don't have to spend that money on our machines because they're immune to things like that. The software that we use is mature. It's reliable. You've heard other people talk about the reliability. When we opened the school this fall, we provided no training for students or staff. It's all point-and-click software. The software you're seeing right now is open-source software. It's not difficult to use. It's very easy to use. A lot of our kids did not even know they weren't using the same software they'd used before. It works. And that's the most important reason that we chose to use open-source software was reliability. My job is to make technology in schools transparent. I want the focus to be on learning. If there was something that was better, I would find a way to pay for it. But for us, open source is the best solution. The fact that it's free is great. It also means that the community where I work, when I tell them that I need to spend money, they know that I work very, very hard to save every dime I can. And they understand our commitment to open source software. For me, if I can do something for free, it's unethical to spend a lot of money to do it. Now, I personally don't know them, but my guess is that there are some public employees out there who enjoy spending state money. No. I don't know. I try to make every little dime my school district has stretch. And so for me, that free part is important. It's the free in terms of dollars. There's also free in terms of the open standards, the open documents, and you're going to hear other people talk about that. But the last two words on this screen, it works, it's free, and then the last one is duh. Okay? I'm happy.
You got that?
And that's really what I have to say. This, no one is asking anyone to do anything radical here. This is proven software. It works. It's reliable. The cost now and in the future, it's understandable. The cost is free. And I can get more done using it. And so for us, as a public school spending public dollars, it's just kind of a duh. So obviously we consider using open source software, and we do use it. But, you know, we're not saying that that's the only software you can use. If there's other things that you need to use proprietary software for, then we do that, and we do that in our building. But where open source software is the right answer, we use it because we think that's the ethical way to spend the public dollars we have. So I'm going to pass it over to the big fish here, Eric Harrison from the Multnomah County ESD.
Hello, Mr. Chairman, representatives.
Thank you.
My name is Eric Harrison. I'm the Supervisor of Network Services for Multnomah Education Service District. Try to say that one three times fast. Basically, I'm responsible for providing network services to the schools in Multnomah County. We serve approximately 100,000 students, which is one-fifth of the students in the state. We have a fairly large network. Over the last 3 years, we've started experimenting with open source software, and our initial results were good enough that we managed to overcome the obstacles for implementing open source software in a government agency. And I'm going to describe a little bit of what the results we've achieved. We found that for our network services, that over three-quarters of the services we provide, open source software was a superior solution. And not only was it a superior solution, but it was much less expensive. We have the issue of our resources are dwindling at the same time that technology is just exploding in schools. Every year, our demand for resources doubles. It means whatever I do this year, I have to do twice as much next year at the same time my budget is going down. By leveraging open source software, we've been able to reduce my budget by over $200,000 per year, while not only keeping up with this explosive rate of technology, but offering new services and offering improved services, greater reliability, much better track record with security. The grand summary is, all I can say is that for House Bill 2892, that it covers what we have, our experience of what it covers has been that there's just no reason why you should not consider open source software. Where it makes sense, you should do it. The results, once we broke through the barriers of trying it, have just been fantastic, and we highly encourage you to vote for this bill. Thank you.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Quentin Hartman. I am the Academic Computing and Networking Services Coordinator for Fern Ridge School District in Vinita. My school district is also a small fry. In the last year since I've taken over there, I've used open source to great effect in my school district. And in my school district, our budget is such that it wasn't a matter of saving money. It was a matter of, can we achieve this project, can we provide these services, or can we not? The proprietary solutions the cost of the proprietary solutions was of such a level that there was, excuse me, simply no way we could possibly provide those services using proprietary solutions. Using open source has allowed me to provide a second internet and word processing lab in my middle school. It has allowed me to provide file sharing services. It has allowed me to provide a unified logon. It has allowed me to provide a secure system that is usable by my students and my staff. And it just frankly would not have been possible without open source software.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. Paul or Eric, would you just real quickly describe the, I guess, Paul, you would need to do this, describe the thin client project that you have at Riverdale, because I think that's something that's fairly impressive.
Yeah, this is really exciting. Schools get a lot of donated equipment, and computers that we bought 5 years ago, that's kind of the state of the equipment that we get when it's donated. And how long will a computer last? Not very long. So we came up with what's called the thin client solution using open source software, where by installing a single server, you can put a floppy disk into an old computer, and like magic, it boots off the server and it's a brand new computer running free software. So it does two things. It lets us keep our older computers in service longer, and it means that we can delay or completely put off having to buy brand new computers and brand new software. And you see the little IBM computer in the picture there, that's a thin client. There's hardly anything inside that box. That was a brand new computer. It cost $86. Every single one of the computers that we buy costs under $100. There are no moving parts for me to maintain. There's no software to install. I plug it into the wall, and away it goes. And when we say open source equals better software, the reason we were able to do that is because we had access to the code. We could get into the software code, make changes, make it run better, make it do what we needed it to do, and that's where we're saving the money. And we're not alone. In the first year that this software came out, we released it so that other schools could use it. Over 15,000 schools had downloaded copies from all over the world. And so, like I say, we're not talking about, you know, strange, risky movements, or it's not something, you know, unusual that's happening here. It's kind of a groundswell of people that are enjoying the success of having access to the code, making software do what they want it to do, saving money, making it work.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Hartman, do you use a thin client type project at Ferndale?
In fact, I use their very same thin client distribution at my middle school.
Okay.
And I've done so with great success.
And just want, Portland Public Schools is undergoing an ambitious project now, originally designed to install 100 labs of this software at a savings of $15,000 a lab.
Wow.
And again, you do the math, it starts to add up when we talk about scale.
Okay. Mr. Harrison, do you have...
Yes, I was also going to add that one of the important things that's mentioned in this bill, it's very difficult to get, is this isn't necessarily two separate products that we're comparing, but one is a concept. And one of the open source software, part of the concept is that we have the rights to modify it and redistribute it. So I could take the software that I implemented at Multnomah ESD, modify it in such a way that it's useful for these two school districts. And I can provide it to them for free. So not only am I saving my agency money, but the work I do is having a ripple effect throughout the state.
Great. Gentlemen, yes.
Just to use your food analogy, Representative Mabry, imagine that you could buy fruit from Dole or from Sunkist, or you have a community-grown orchard where you can simply go get fruit for free for your organization. It's not necessarily a question of buying something from one vendor or another. It's a question of buying something from a vendor or using a resource that is freely available to you, that's brought to you by your community.
Yeah, Representative Mabry?
It's still a mystery to me, but it's getting there. But everything I've been handed this morning is associated with a name that says Linux.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just not a different name for Studebaker? Now I aged myself, didn't I? Nobody knows
Studebakers, huh?
Linux is just an operating system like Windows. It's one of the most prominent open source projects, but open source is more than just Linux. I have a Windows machine that I use at work, yet all the software I use on the Windows machine is open source software.
Okay, and follow-up?
Follow-up.
So if all this is free, how do you guys make a living? I don't understand.
Most of the business models that are based on open source that have been successful are based on the idea of providing support to the products that they release for free. People who choose to use the products can use the products and then learn them sufficiently themselves and support them themselves, or they can pay a company such as Red Hat to come in and provide that support for them.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate you taking the time out of your school day to be down here with us. Let me have let me just say for the folks here, I recognize that we've blown the hell out of our time frame for this. So what I want to do is make sure that we get the people that I know that have come from out of town able to testify, and I'm going to allow about 7 more minutes for proponents, and then we've got to move into the opponents so that they have an opportunity to speak on this bill as well. So let me have Sean Savage, Andrew Spearing, and Kevin Hagen go ahead and come on up.
My name is Sean Savage, and thank you very much for having us here today. I've worked in the computer industry for 25 years, and I've been using open source software for over 10. I received my undergrad in computer science from the University of Utah and received my graduate degree in electrical engineering from OSU. I am in favor of House Bill 2892. I'm going to talk about the philosophy of open source software. The philosophy of open source software is you have control. You have control of the costs. It's free. You have control of security. There's no viruses. You can add mandatory access control. In fact, the NSA has a distribution that is secure. You have control of features. You can modify it any way you like. You can add things. You can take away things. And you have the power to control innovation. The terminal server is a wonderful concept of this. They took something that was out there, modified it, and now the state uses it. And you have the power to control knowledge that open source brings to you. This is an important issue. For the software is the first time in the history of mankind that knowledge is tangible. Okay? Every time you add to an open source project, it can be used any place and transferred to anyone for free. So every time you add something, that helps the total common good of mankind's cognizance. For security, it's not prone to Linux is not prone to viruses, and like I said, NSA even has a distribution which is ultra secure. costs. Not only is it free, but the maintenance costs are lower. You don't have to go out running around fixing viruses. Like someone said earlier, there's two routes. There's two people. There's the users and there's administrators. Also, instead of paying for millions of dollars a year to a convicted criminal monopoly, the state can create its own distribution for much less and provide it to the state for free. Thank you.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Well, I'm Kevin Hagan. I'm also from Washington County. I'm with Mars Apps with Sean Savage. I'm fairly new to the open source world, but the important thing here is we have to look at the bottom line. Our state is in a budget crisis. We need to do what's most economically sound for the state. Linux, open source software in general, is safe. It's secure, and it's free. As one of our colleagues stated, duh, we should use it. Now, there's one thing that's inevitably true about any representative democracy, and it's how it should be. Government moves slowly, and knowledge that the government acquires is sometimes slow to filter down to the people. But that should, under no circumstances, be caused by a bad computer system. It shouldn't be because of computer problems. It should be because of the process of the democracy under which this country was founded, that people are carefully reviewing bills. You guys should not be having issues communicating with each other because of a bad computer system. The amount of time that it takes to pass a bill should be because you're debating it, and under a true Jeffersonian democracy, you're discussing this to do what's best for the state of Oregon. This piece of legislation doesn't mandate anything but the acceptance of reviewing the possibility of using open source software as opposed to normal software or proprietary software. The bottom line is open source software is completely safe, it's secure, and it allows for the state to save money. Thank you.
Thank you.
First off, my name is Andrew Spearing. As with them, I'm with MoZaps. I think there was a phrase used here earlier, cost effectiveness. I think what's better than free? I think that that's something that really has been emphasized a lot here, but I don't think it's been emphasized to a great level. We throw out numbers, you know, that this costs nothing, but let's look at the proprietary software, which we are currently putting on every system, and how much it costs. I did a little checking this morning, and the average Word application, we'll just say, for instance, Office XP, utilizes a vast amount of money. Let's just throw out a number, $579 per client. Now, I don't know how cost-effective that is to $0, where the open source world applies to that. There is nothing. Where you go to every client, we can look at the academic system, where Oregon supplies a system with reduced costs, $20 per client for every system we want to use. Well, if you apply that to a large system, let's just say, for instance, 250 clients per school, 12 schools, you're now reaching up to $60,000, whereas with the open source possibility, there again I emphasize, $0. So I think when you have to look at this from, you know, an economic standpoint, it's saving not just vast amounts of money, it's saving vast, vast, vast amounts of money. I mean, this is so beyond what we're, you know, currently doing that it would be illogical not to look upon it and, you know, think about the possibility of being cost effective. I think an analogy that is simple to understand, because I understand that not everybody understands the initiative of open source. If you had Department A and Department B, and you had a budget of $5,000 for each department, would it not be logical to use something that didn't cost you anything, still provided the same features, if not better features in some cases, than the proprietary software you're spending $579 for or $299 for? That to me just seems logical. So in that, I just urge the fact that this is not only economical, but it saves vast, vast, vast amounts of money. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for this? Thank you. With that, I'm going to I need to move to the opponents. I apologize to folks that have signed up to testify, and if you have written testimony, I would ask you to go ahead and submit that to us, please. We have Jim Craven, Mario Correa, and Kevin Campbell. Come on up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks for having us here. Jim Craven, American Electronics Association. Your panel consists of three national trade associations who have an interest in this bill. Mario Correa here is welcome him from Washington, D.C., on my right, from the Business Software Alliance, and Kevin Campbell representing the Initiative for Software Choice. Kevin, did you want to?
Sure, I'll begin. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today on behalf of the Initiative for Software Choice. That's a coalition of groups, mainly associations and other software companies from around the world. In fact, if you look at the testimony that's before you that I've presented, there will be a listing of the worldwide companies. And then what I've done in addition to that is I've listed 70 Oregon companies that are a part of one member of that large association called CompTIA. That'll give you a feel for some of the software producers that that are in our own backyard that participate in this whole area. What you will not hear me say this morning is you won't hear me say that proprietary software should be considered above any other software. In fact, our whole point of view in this coalition, some of the members of which work with open source software, is that all of them should be considered, and that the best option for the purchaser should be selected. And I think you've heard already this morning from some of the testimony that occurred already. That did in fact happen. That tells me that the market does work, that this kind of option is available and can be obtained. So with that, let me make some brief comments, and then I'll turn it over to the gentleman sitting next to me. I do want to say currently Oregon, like every other state, employs a process based on purchases that include the consideration of value for money, which is a part of this bill, by the way, and we support completely. That concept is the concept that we support in purchasing decisions. This state employs that process, and the Initiative for Software Choice supports Oregon's flexible and common sense approach. No law, rule, or regulation stands in the way of Oregon software procurement professionals from obtaining the most appropriate software for its needs. For that reason, ISC urges the Oregon legislature to reject the bill. It would impose unnecessary micromanagement that would prevent Oregon from obtaining the best software solutions in many cases, hurt Oregon companies in the information technology business, and would violate potentially some international trade law. House Bill 2892 directs procurement officials, those that do the purchasing, to acquire software products, as I mentioned, primarily on a value-for-money basis. We strongly endorse it. But it also includes exceptions that would preclude that objective. An exception to the requirement would prohibit the state from acquiring those products that do not comply with open standards of interoperability or data storage, which would eliminate many proprietary software products and even some hybrid offerings, which is a combination of the two, from consideration, undermining the effectiveness of Oregon's public administration. In many cases, those products could be the best solution for the state on a value-for-money basis. Now, House Bill 2892 would also require procurement officials, purchasers, to provide written justification for the selection of any other proprietary software, but it doesn't require that for the purchase or the obtaining of the open source products. The ISC believes this potentially burdensome requirement would also discourage purchasing officials from selecting proprietary software in cases where it represents the value for money proposition for the state and its taxpayers. In either case, the outcome could not only be against the best interests of Oregon taxpayers, but it could actually hurt firms in Oregon, including both Oregon proprietary and hybrid software companies, and a large number of Oregon software resellers who offer proprietary software to the state. The vast majority of software producers, distributors, resellers, and workers deal primarily with proprietary software. So these restrictions could only hurt more Oregon companies and workers than it could help. Now, by removing proprietary and even hybrid software solutions from the table, House Bill 2892 will end up wasting taxpayer dollars, leading to reduced competition, which will decrease the available choices of viable software options. This will bring about increased cost for software acquisition, development, training, expertise, and other related services. Now, let me conclude my testimony by saying that if House Bill 2892 does, in fact, get enacted, it'd be the first such preference law passed in the United States. It's the current policy of the United States government and all its states to approach this from a value for money approach. So this is swim against the tide of an evolving technology and free markets that we currently enjoy in the United States. It does not need to occur. Instead of House Bill 2892's prescriptive approach, the policy used by the U.S. and its states, including Oregon, relying on the best of breed instead of how a piece of software was bred, should be maintained by Oregon's procurement officials. In doing so, Oregon continue to more flexibly look at all software options for its software needs, using merit-based choice to underlie all its software acquisitions. And I did want to mention to Representative Mabry that the fruit analogy, I tried to take fruit from an orchard once, and I almost got shot. I think it was the wrong type of orchard. That may not have been one of those community orchards that we were looking for. With that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll turn it over to my colleagues. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Can we hold questions until the panel is done, please? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, for the record, once again, Jim Craven representing the American Electronics Association. We're the nation's largest trade association representing the high-tech industry with more than 3,500 member companies around the country. About a third of our member companies are software companies, and software is the fastest-growing segment of the high-tech industry in the United States. Included among our members are software firms that are exploring and working both the open-source software model as well as what has been referred to as the proprietary model. And we have companies that you would call hybrid that are working in both space and support products on both types of platforms. Obviously, you've got an introduction this morning that this is an issue that elicits great passion from the proponents. And I would have to say that that passion is great and it's warranted, and it seems to me that we need to direct our attention to the bill before us rather than the great theme that we've sort of been talking about this morning, because the bill before us is what we're voting on, not whether or not open source software is a good product and could save people money. In many cases, it absolutely probably could, and it seems like the presentations of the panel previous to us have gone off and pursued those cost savings, have purchased these types of products, and they work for their school districts, and we think that's just fabulous, and it seems like they had all the rights they needed to go buy these products without passing a bill. And I think we think that's the situation that the state of Oregon is in, too, that it has the authority to do what this bill purports to give them authority to do. I caution you not to look at this issue as a battle of black and white and as a battle of good and evil. It sometimes gets that way, but I don't really think that's what the reality is. And I do, again, you know, urge you to focus on what's in the bill itself rather than, you know, the theoretical debate about what is the best type of software for people to purchase. AEA opposes this bill, and very much in line with the testimony of Mr. Campbell and the ISC, and that we believe it is not purely a level playing field bill, and that it does tip state procurement in the direction of one type of product over another. And I think hopefully we'll get Department of Administrative Services up here, and I think we're going to let the state procurement agency speak for itself, speak to its current policies and what it can and cannot do and what it does and does not do already without passage of the bill. Two specifics why this is not just a allows people to look at something. The bill requires that agencies, when they purchase proprietary software, to, quote, provide justification for those purchases. We think rather than a cost savings, this could actually be a cost additor if agencies have to go through complex pro formas on every to defend basically a purchase of a certain type of software. It's the same point that Mr. Campbell made. And also on page 2 on lines 36 through 38, it says that the state shall avoid the acquisition of products that do not comply with open standards for interoperability or data storage. The word avoid sounds like a prohibition to me, not like a level playing field. So I do think this bill basically is a tipping the state in a certain direction rather than allowing people to consider, because we believe that DAS and other state agencies can consider the purchase of open source platforms now. Indeed, they do purchase such platforms when they provide the best value for money for state government. And I'm going to let DAS speak for itself on that point. So we also agree with all the previous testimony that government agencies should strive to spend tax dollars wisely, particularly in these times, while meeting their critical information technology needs. And ultimately, we believe that the market forces should drive those decisions rather than the legislature sort of trying to sort this out with this bill. So I'm going to conclude there, turn it over to Mr. Carrera, our distinguished guest from out of town.
Thanks, Jim.
Everybody's got to have an expert, right?
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
We're not it, are we? You knew that.
Why we brought in Mr. Carrera. Why you brought him in.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mario Correa. I'm Director of Software Policy for the Business Software Alliance. It's a pleasure to be here today and have the chance to speak on this bill. As a graduate student years ago, I actually did my thesis on the state legislature, so it's a real honor for me to be here before you today. And BSA member companies represent some of the leading developers of software, hardware, and internet developers. And our member companies in Oregon alone employ over 20,000 people. And they are part of an industry that raises about $160 million in terms of tax revenues directly and indirectly to the state. Now, it's no surprise to anyone, our industry has had many troubles over the last few years, as have many parts of our economy, both here in Oregon and in other states. Nonetheless, despite these difficulties, technological innovation in the state continues. And that is in no small part due to the fact that this legislature has wisely not sought to determine the way technology does or does not develop in the state. It has let the market make that decision. And as we saw today, that has led to some great developments, including folks who avail themselves of open source technologies and others who develop other kinds of technologies. Now, 2892, however, flies in the face of this tradition, for it puts the state squarely in the position of picking technological winners and losers, as Jim alluded to. Now, we as BSA and our member companies disagree fundamentally with the notion that government should determine what is or what is not an appropriate mode of software development, and the preferences in this bill do just that. Now, we totally agree with the bill's stated desire to create value for money-based procurement decisions. That makes absolute sense. But where we disagree is with the bill's prejudging of what constitutes value for dollar. And that is the bill putting forward the viewpoint of the sponsors in terms of what constitutes value for dollar, as opposed to letting state IT professionals continue to make that judgment based on their knowledge of the products at hand. Now, this is a particularly important point because the bill makes, I think, a fundamental error, and that is that it purports that open source software is de facto free. Now, open source software is very good. Many open source developments are wonderful, but it is not free. The costs of supporting, maintaining, retraining, and otherwise functionalizing open source software are at least comparable to those of commercial software products. Studies show that only about 5% of the costs of a software product are from its initial acquisition. The vast majority of its costs come from the cost of operating it through IT personnel. Now, HB 2892 makes another error in our view, and that is it equates open source software with software made available only on non-commercial terms. Now, many of our member companies develop open source software, but they make that software available on terms that have commercial pricing and licensing as well attached to them. But under this bill, even those products could not be procured without a separate justification. So instead of seeking to, in fact, advance open source development, what we're seeing in this bill is an effort to advance free software writ large and to essentially exclude a fair level playing field for commercial products. Now, that would ultimately be self-defeating because the state's tech industry depends on a fair and level playing field in order to prosper here in the state. And effectively, state procurement is a very large part of overall development and procurement in the state. Now, most importantly, state agencies' own hands will be tied in this process because you will be asking state IT pros to make decisions based on what they perceive as the preference of the state legislature about development models, not about what products necessarily suit their needs. And in the process, you'll see the impact in the state's tech economy. Now, we understand fully, and particularly in these economic times in the state of Oregon and otherwise, in other states, the difficulties budgets are facing and the need to find cost savings wherever possible. But this bill is not a guarantee of cost savings. It is, however, a guarantee that the level playing field that Oregon does have about technology development will no longer exist. And in our view, that's a mistake. Thanks very much for the chance to participate.
Thank you. Did you have a closing comment?
No, Mr. Chair. I would like to hope that Daskin gets a few minutes before we wrap this up. So we'd like to end if we have time to bring up the department.
We will make sure that we get Dask up here. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Nelson?
It was just, Mr. Chair, just for a definition, I'd just like to ask Mr. Campbell to define the word proprietary as he used it in his testimony.
Yeah, proprietary just means that the software is obviously developed by an entity that has control over that product, just as if you were creating a serial product. You would have control over its production, distribution, the cost, the licensing. You have put a large amount of effort and your resources into a product that you didn't have some control over. And the gentleman next to me, that's the common dictionary definition I'd give you. And then if you want one that's a little more accurate and technical, I'd look down to my right and your left.
Pretty good job.
Would you?
Quick follow-up.
Is that fair?
Right.
Is that fair? Okay.
Thank you. No.
I wonder if is there a great opportunity for enhanced economic development in the state by further supporting open source software? I mean, is that the issue really behind all this?
Chairman, members of the committee, I think that the further development of open source software is a great opportunity for companies both in Oregon and elsewhere. But I think what this debate shows is that that's not that it's not needed in terms of legislation to sort of set that development along. I think some of the greatest technological innovations that we're seeing in the state are in fact of open source variety. But that's been happening without legislature necessarily setting forth preferences. So I think that can be accomplished in the current climate as well.
Thank you. Representative Worth?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions. First of all, Mr. Craven, so if, as representative of the AEA, would you say then that all of your clients are opposing this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, all my clients, we did not, in fairness, do a poll of all 3,500 member companies. It is our association's position, however. I'm not exactly sure of the question.
Okay, I'm going to follow up on my own.
I'll give you that for
Follow up.
And I guess what I meant to say is your association. Would you say that some of the members of your association stand to benefit from this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, potentially. But what I think you hear the three of us saying is the benefit ought to be on a market basis, on a value for money basis, in a system that we currently have that allows state procurement officials to pick the best product for the state dollars. And we think that's currently the situation in Oregon, and that's, I think, our companies are basically competition-based and market-based proponents, and they don't mind duking it out in the market.
Final question.
Follow up.
And Mr. Carrera, is that correct? You spoke of some cost studies, and can you tell me how or who commissioned those or identify them, who commissioned them?
Sure. IDC, the firm of IDC, conducted the study. I think Microsoft and some other companies actually were in part of that study. Now, when IDC's study was conducted, it was an interesting point on two things, and I think, in fact, one of the issues that that Jim alluded to, I think, in terms of your previous question, is important. That is that I think that open source developers want the same thing that traditional commercial and proprietary developers do, which is the chance to compete fairly. You asked if, Representative Wirth, if you thought that companies would stand to gain, if we thought companies stand to gain under this bill. I think companies stand to gain when they have the incentives in place to develop the best products they possibly can. And I think those incentives are much stronger when that playing field is, in fact, level, because they know that they have to beat other products, quote-unquote, by virtue of the quality and value of those products. And I think that in terms of having a preference set forth that makes that playing field uneven, the incentives are weakened, and therefore your products, in fact, are weakened as a result as well. So I would argue that, in fact, all companies have something to gain by having the level playing field of the state currently. Does.
Okay, if I could just quickly pull up. Mr. Carrera, but that's the question I was trying to get from you.
Sure.
Who had funded those studies? And you said Microsoft and some others.
I believe, I'm not sure exactly who paid for the IDC study, but IDC, as you know, is a very reputable computer policy researcher.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you very much, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, members of the committee.
Let me have, you bet. I know that, let's see, we have Deborah Bryant from DAS, and we also have Chris Sells, who is noted as being against us. Could I have the two of you come up, please? And
I'm not sure if I signed in correctly, so I'm also opposed. My name is Mike Sachs. I'm sorry.
Mike Sachs?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask Mr. Dugan Petty from the department to join me for our testimony.
Okay. That would be fine. And since I know, Chris, that you're not with DAS, are you?
No.
Let me have you. No. I want you to come up. Let me have you go first.
Oh, okay.
And then I'm going to have the department go.
Okay.
Sure. Okay. Oh, excuse me. Thank you. So go ahead.
Thank you for letting me be here today. I've never done anything like this before, so please excuse me if I do something wrong. My name is Chris Sells, and I'm an independent consultant. I've been doing software development of one kind or another since I was about 12 years old, so about 20 years. And so based on that, you probably expect me to be for this bill. But first and foremost, I'm an engineer. And so when I look at something, I look at it from a very technical standpoint. And there's a lot of things in this bill that I really like. I really like encouraging the state government to consider open source software. If it meets the needs of whatever state agency is looking at the software, if it meets the cost requirements, then I'm all for it. but there's one very sticky point in this bill that had me drive down an hour this morning to talk to you today, which are lines 34 and 35, which require to any agency considering proprietary software to provide justification whenever a proprietary software product is acquired rather than open source software. That one sentence is why I'm here today. That's bad engineering, because what that does is it limits you to only considering open source software unless the person making the decision is so passionate that they're willing to do that extra work and go that extra mile to justify closed source proprietary software. I don't think that restriction should be in place. I absolutely am in favor of open standards for data. I believe that applications, software come and go, but that data is going to be around decades. And so those are all good things. Also, a couple of things that I'd kind of like to clear up. One is that because you're using open source software, that there's no such thing as a virus or security problems. That's actually, in my experience, not true. In fact, the very first computer virus ever invented was invented and distributed under Unix, and it almost killed the Internet before it kind of had a chance to take off. And Unix is the predecessor to Linux. And I'm a big fan of Linux, but it's just because it's open source does not mean it's free of viruses or security problems. Also, open source does not necessarily mean open standards. Open standards are those standards that are either ratified officially by standards body, worldwide standards body, or ad hoc by the business community or the technical community at large. And in fact, it's my experience that it's proprietary software vendors that have, especially in recent years, been the biggest proponents of both data storage in open standards formats and communication in those open standards formats. And those formats actually require extra engineering and manpower and costs to make sure that they're completely implemented. And it's those software companies that actually have an income stream that are most able to push those for the benefit of the community at large, the world. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Go ahead, Deborah.
For the record, my name is Deborah Bryant. I'm from the Department of Administrative Services, Information Resources Management Division. With me today is Mr. Dugan Petty, who represents in the same agency the State Procurement Office. I don't want to recover a lot of testimony that's been given today.
Thank you.
I also would like to keep the conversation out of the depths of technology and think about where I can add the most value to the conversation. The agency's position on the bill is that we strongly support the use of open source software, but we have to go on the record as unable to support the bill unless we could see some changes to the language. And we've provided in our written testimony some suggestions to change the language in the bill. And I've also had an opportunity to meet with some of the bill proponents, or at least one of the bill proponents, who thought some of the language's change was good. I think what I'd like to share with you so the committee understands is that open source software is used in a number of state agencies today. We did a straw poll back in December. There were 10 agencies that reported they were either evaluating or using open source software in their operations. That number is probably doubled by now, though we haven't done a recent poll. And also, in terms of talking about the technology, open source refers to a great breadth of technology. Open source will show up in things like telephone systems and development tools and desktop systems and operating systems. So in that respect, you can't say that saving one thing here is the same as somewhere else. So we're evaluating things on the basis of the technology. Some agencies, for instance, are looking very seriously at desktop systems because there is enormous savings there, but it has to be evaluated within the context of the business of the agency. Having said that, I will just ask if you have any questions, because I know we've gone pretty long in the testimony today.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, just from the purchasing standpoint, my name is Dugan Petty. I'm the deputy administrator with the Procurement, Fleet, and Surplus Services Division of DAS. This bill, from the procurement standpoint, the part about value for money, the total cost of the software, that makes good sense to us in the context of the architecture for the information technology system. Those are the kinds of decisions that we try to make when we buy anything. We are concerned about how we spend the state's money, and we do want to get the best value we can for the public's money. But the bill does seem to go beyond that. It actually does not just level the playing field, but it tips it. And it tips it in a direction where there are preferences and a default towards the open system software, or the open source software, which may actually be more difficult to administer and more costly. So we think that to the extent that it makes sense from a cost standpoint, we ought to be looking at that from a total cost standpoint. But it should be a level playing field, and we think this bill goes a little further than making it a level playing field.
Okay. Thank you. Are there questions for this panel? Okay. Great. Thank you very much. Mr. Simmons, why don't you come on up? That's okay. My fault. I didn't look on the second page when I was running down my opponent's list. So.
Well, I have very high appreciation for what you're doing in the legislature, and I know that you, each and every one of you, have the very best intentions for our state's institutions and our schools and our children. But sometimes the very best intentions can even have unintended disastrous consequences. And And that's why I decided to come here and testify, because there's a common wisdom.
Let me stop you just for a second. I need you to state your name for the record.
I apologize. My name is Mike Sachs, S as in Sam, A-X, and I own a small software company in Eugene, Oregon.
Thank you.
There's a common wisdom that says there's no such thing as a free lunch. And the modern version of that is there's no such thing as really free software. And what this bill does is it only lets you look at the cost of acquiring the software, but it doesn't really look at the total cost of ownership, which the purchase price is just a very small part of that. There's also implementing it, training the people to work with, converting existing data, integrating systems, and things like that. And Representative Mabry, I really like your analogy to buying cereal for the inmates. And I believe that what this bill is basically saying is if it's food and it's free, you should buy it. But you mentioned that you need to look at everything. You need to look at the total cost of ownership, which means what is the nutritional value? Does it need to be stored in refrigerators, or can we store it in warehouses? Are inmates going to be constipated from eating this food? We need to look at the whole thing. And so we're encouraging our institutions to make a very short-sighted decision making process. And so if you look at this open source movement, it was started by a whole bunch of enthusiasts, but there's a very strong and big business around it, which is why it's become a force in software. Companies like IBM and Red Hat and other companies are investing a lot of money into this. And for example, Red Hat Software, which is the primary provider of Linux software, which is what we just saw, that's their whole business. They provide open source software. They have a market capitalization of $980 million. I checked on the internet yesterday. They are basically, their whole business model is based on the idea that people who get open source free software will need an endless stream of services, consulting, training, and other things that requires, that they need to keep that software operational. That's why Wall Street is giving them a market capitalization of $980 million. It's almost $1 billion. If this bill gets voted, it'll probably become more than $1 billion. So essentially, Red Hat Software is giving free rice to our inmates, and they're in the business of making medicine for constipation. So I'm not saying that open software is bad, and in a lot of cases it can be a great solution, and we've seen this. But the decision-making process to buy software should not be something that is based on the price to acquire the software, but it should be based on the total cost of ownership. And companies that provide free software don't have an incentive to make that software very easy to use. Companies that have an upfront price software model make all their or most of their money on the price you pay up front where you own the software for life. They don't make any money out of support. So they have a very strong incentive to make that software very easy to use, easy to maintain, and therefore very inexpensive to own. And so I believe in a lot of things that are good in this bill, but I also believe that the bill as it is right now is very unfinished, is forcing people to make very short-term decisions. It's like borrowing money at a high interest rate. It's very attractive in the short term. It gives you a short-term incentive because you get something for nothing, but ultimately it puts a very unbearable long-term burden on our schools and our other institutions. And that's something I think we should not allow to happen, and we should allow people to make that decision independently and not force them by creating this law. I think our schools need more teachers. They don't need more software administrators. Our children need more teachers, not more software administrators. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Mr. Stacks? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Appreciate you being here. With that, then, before I close the public hearing on House Bill 2892, here's what I would like to do, because I think there obviously there's great interest in the procurement issues and this type of legislation. I would like to ask Mr. Harrison and Nelson and Barber if you would be willing to work with Mr. Craven, Campbell, and Gardner. I know Gardner didn't testify today, but I know he's been monitoring this. And then also if Mr. Petty from DAS and Ms. Bryant, if you would get together as a work group and sort of look at the bill and look at it from a standpoint of amendments that might be offered to see if this is a bill that we want to move that we actually do want to move forward. Mr. Representative Prezanski.
Can I volunteer one other name for that work group?
Certainly.
Representative Bill Barnhart.
If he'll get well and get his butt back here, then yes.
I'm working on
that. Okay, and Representative Barnhart, yes, I think that's an excellent idea. And then what I would like to have you do, if you would please, is, and I know that this is a very short time frame, but we are now on a fairly short time frame as far as the legislative session is concerned. I would like you to get together as quickly as you can and see if there's amendments that would cause us to want to go ahead and move this bill forward. And I need you to basically report back to us by April 15th. And I know that, like I said, that's a very short time frame, but we need to kind of cook this puppy along if we're going to be able to move it. And I would like you to if you can form a work group kind of and do that, then I appreciate your involvement and your willingness to help us out with this issue. Yes, Representative.
I think the other thing I'd suggest is that since Representative Barnhart, since Bill is a sponsor, maybe his office can coordinate getting the rooms assignment or whatever might be necessary if they're planning on meeting here at the Capitol.
That would be terrific. That would be terrific. And so, yes, let's go ahead and volunteer his office to coordinate that. So if you would all just coordinate through Representative Barnhart, then that I would appreciate that. Okay. With that, then, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2892, and I want to thank you all for being here today. You would be as quiet as you can as you leave. We have a couple of other things, members, that we're going to try to do before we adjourn. Let me open a public hearing on House Bill 3068. And Representative Prezanski, do you want to introduce this from the...
Here would be great.
From here would be great. Okay. That would be fine.
Mr. Chair, this is a bill that's coming to you on House Bill 3068. I have two individuals that I know that are here to testify, Mary Bachman and Denise Forbeck. This is a concern that DOJ employees have, and we've expanded the bill to include all public body workers as to having their pictures being requested through a public records request. It's my understanding that they are concerned that at least DOJ's interpretation of the rule as it stands today, they would be required to provide that photo identification of that employee over the objection of the employee. What we're concerned with is not identity theft here, but as much as the work that Warbeck will tell you about that she's involved in and others, is that we could actually have stalking or some other type of retribution against employees by being able to identify them by face as they leave their place of employment.
Great. Why don't you go ahead?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Botkin. For the record, I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We represent the Assistant Attorney Generals at the Department of Justice, and I am in deference to your time, let me just briefly state that we worked with Representative Przanski and our DOJ folks, and with me today is Denise Fjordbeck. Sorry, just like the name. It was a bubble in time. Anyway, Denise will talk very specifically about the need for the bill. But let me just briefly tell you that under the construction of public records law in Oregon, we are a sunshine state. We think everything ought to be open to the public, and our union supports that, generally speaking. The only thing that is not open to public records disclosure are the issues or the things that are itemized as exempt. And that is where we are right now with public employee name badges and IDs. And I think that, again, in deference to your time and other bills you have, I'll let Denise talk about the issue and the need for the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Denise. Yes, Vice Chair Przanski and members of the committee, Chair Krummel. I'm Denise Fjordbeck, and as Mary said, I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice. I work in the Appellate Division of the Department. Before I start my remarks, I would like to apologize to Chair Krummel for my inadvertently misspelling your name on my written testimony. My fingers sometimes get ahead of my brain when I'm typing. And as someone with a difficult name, I should be more sensitive. I have been an employee of the Department of Justice now for about 13 years. During that time, I've done a variety of things. Right now, I represent the parole board, notably, in cases involving inmates, whether they will or will not get out and when, cases involving parolees, what their conditions of parole might be, whether they're designated as predatory sex offenders, for example. And over the years, in general, working on behalf of the state, I have received a number of threats, some in writing, some verbally, some implicit and some express. Some of them have been serious enough that we've reported them to the state police for investigation. Our concern about the photo ID badges is that we support the efforts of state agencies to make people more safe within the workplace. And the photo ID badge accomplishes that by making sure we don't have unauthorized people in the workplace. But in the process of doing that, we're concerned that we are less safe coming and going from the workplace. Some of us do have jobs where we are in direct contact with inmates, people who are under arrest and so forth, but most of us do not. We have a paper relationship with them. And frankly, we would not want those people, their friends, their family members, to be able to identify us as we're coming and going from work. We're concerned about stalking. We're concerned about potential for harassment. Obviously, there's a potential there even for violence. And so those are our concerns. In a nutshell, Representative Przanski was good enough to work with us to try and craft a bill that accomplishes that protection, but yet allows the state government and, for that matter, the local government bodies to do what they need to do with the photo ID badges. And unless there are questions, I think that's all that I would have to say.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say that I do know that the Department of Transportation and DMV have some amendments. We've looked at those amendments. As often happens, the net got cast a little more broadly than we had intended, so we're fine with the amendments that they're bringing forward.
Okay. Thank you.
One further thing, if I might, Chair Krummel and members of the committee. The Department of Justice does support this bill.
Kevin's behind us.
I didn't see Kevin come back.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for these two ladies? Thank you very much. Okay. Let me have Kelly Taylor and Kevin Neely come on up. I figure you guys, it's okay to have you sit together, isn't it? I mean,
yes.
I know agencies sometimes do, you know, get crossways with each other.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation, and we did work with Representative Przlanski's office and the requesters of the bill, Mary Botkin and members of AFSCME, on the two amendments. The Dash 1 amendments, the purpose of that is we have the driver license photographs on file, and they obviously our employees have driver's licenses. Now, those photographs are only available to law enforcement by statute. But we would not want to compromise an investigation should they ask for a driver's license photograph and then have to cross-file to find out if it's an employee and then go get written permission before we can give it to law enforcement. We think that would compromise our investigation since that's typically why they're asking for them. So what the Dash 1 amendment would say is this provision of not disclosing a photograph does not affect the driver license photographs that are only given to law enforcement, and that's what the Dash 1s will accomplish. What the Dash 2s accomplish is it would change in line 12 of the bill. It would remove the words "to identify" and put the word "of" in. So it would say a public body may use a photograph of an employee of the public body. And that is to accomplish when we have photographs of folks and we're doing a newsletter, a training video, something like that, and you've got people's photographs in there. It's just the public body itself using it. It's not giving it to anyone else. It's using it itself. It would allow that to happen without going to get releases from everybody across the state. And that concludes what I have.
Okay. Thank you.
Kevin. Chair Crumwell, members of the committee, Kevin Neely, Executive Assistant to Attorney General Hardy Myers. I'm here in Hardy's stead. He's trying to get over to this neck of the woods from Ben today, and he simply wanted to extend his strong support of this on behalf of our work with the union and the Department of Justice. That easy.
Okay. I have a question, Kevin, maybe you can answer, and that is we have employees that have their picture taken all the time by newspapers, you know, and that sort of thing. Is this in any way going to stop a newspaper from being able to take a picture of a public employee and print it in there and identify the person as, you know, Kevin Neely with the Department of Justice?
Chair Crummel, it should not. It only deals with these little things right here. I think anything beyond the badge that's taken for the purposes of the employment with the department wouldn't be affected. That's the way that our office has interpreted these. But again, I'm not sure that that's entirely accurate. I can go back and check on it. Sounds like there's a little bit more work to do and get back to you. But that's how it's been interpreted to us.
Okay. Representative Przlanski.
Mr. Chair, I guess my response is it would not have any impact on anyone outside of the public bodies as to the control of the photographs that they actually have in their possession. This is really just to have some type of management control of the photo IDs or photographs that are kept by a public body as it pertains to their employee, and what and it limits what type of use it can be used for in the sense of outside use going being distributed.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Nelson.
Very quickly, I don't know if this is Representative Przlanski or Attorney General's office. I don't see where this just relates to that thing hanging around your neck in this bill. I don't see that at all.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I would agree that it's not just necessarily the lanyard. What it does include is any photograph that has been taken by the public body that is in their possession. If someone makes a request to have that released under the public records, it would in fact be covered by this bill, where it would not be able to be released unless there was approval from the employee, with the exceptions that the Dash 1 and Dash 2 will provide. And that means that the public body could still use these photographs in their own, let's say, in-house publications if they're doing some type of a newsletter, or if law enforcement came to DMV, which they do routinely, and some investigation requesting for a photo ID of anyone, and it just happens to be a public employee for a different public body, the DMV would, in fact, be able to release that.
Chair Carmel, Representative Nelson. I think the better way to clarify it is just to say if it's taken by an employer for the purposes of their employment in the organization, that would be what this covers.
Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Where do I find out what happens if I give your photo out? I don't see where there's any.
Okay.
discipline, or I don't see what happens to me when I give Wally's picture out.
Chair Carmel, Representative Nelson, I'm not sure there's an explicit remedy in the statute. Presumably, the employee would have some cause of action in the courts if they chose to pursue it. I don't know, Representative Brzezinski, if that's how you would view it, too. But.
If I heard the question is what steps could be taken, I would assume there'd be some internal steps within the public body where they could file a complaint or a grievance as to the disclosure, and it would go through the normal general administrative rule process.
Does that answer your question?
No, sir, but that's okay.
Okay. Okay, is there anyone else who wants to speak on House Bill 3068? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill.
Mark Landau, he's kind of raising his finger, so I don't know.
Okay, just pretend like I didn't bang the gavel, okay?
Unbang it.
Yeah, unbang.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, sorry for not leaping to my feet there. I apologize. Mark Landauer with the Office of Government Relations for the City of Portland. I'm city's neutral on this bill. I'd just like to point one thing out that may be concerned to the committee, and I just sort of realized this now, and I'd like to get this confirmed with the sponsors of the bill. But one of the concerns that I just thought of is if an officer, for example, dies in the line of duty, would his photograph that the employer has be releasable, because you would not be able to go back and get the signature of that individual? Just a generalized question. I think that is something that the public would like to see in honor of that individual for his line of duty. Could apply to a firefighter as well, whatnot. Just a thought, and just leave you with that thought. Thank you.
Representative Brzezinski?
Mr. Chair, I don't think there would be a problem. What I want to ask at this point is if we can go ahead and maybe start moving the bill forward. This is something that if it makes it through this committee and to the floor and passes, the Senate would be able to deal with it. I don't believe there would be a problem, because once the person is deceased, those concerns and conditions that we've heard on the record as to why they would not want it to be released have
evaporated
or expired.
Understood.
Okay. Great. Then with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3068. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3068. Representative Brzezinski?
I move the dash ones of the amendments into 3068.
Representative Brzezinski moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 3068. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Brzezinski?
I move the dash twos into the House Bill 3068.
Representative Brzezinski moves the dash two amendments into House Bill 3068. Are there any, is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Brzezinski?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3068 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Brzezinski moves House Bill 3068 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Nelson?
I will, out of courtesy, vote to pass this bill. I think there are some other circumstances and some disciplinary and discipline issues that haven't been addressed as to what if these are misused, abused, and hopefully we'll clarify that before we get it on the House floor.
Okay. So noted. Any other discussion? Seeing none, Gina, call the roll, please.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye. Excused. Aye. House Bill 3068, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Brzezinski, you want to carry it?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3068. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3023. I'm going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3023. I'm going to, let's see, and that's it. We will take up House Bill 2048 at our Tuesday meeting, and it will be the first item on the agenda. 2148. Yeah, isn't that what I said?
No,
2148. Anyway,
we
will
take
it up. And with that, we need to adjourn. And please go directly to the floor as they are trying to establish a quorum.